Isaiah chapter 26, please, and verse number 3. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. You will permit me just to read that again with a marginal reading. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind stops at God. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is a rock of ages. Now turn back further to the book of Esther, please. The book of Esther in chapter 1. And if you'll bear with me, we will read some scattered verses in Esther, but trusting to the acquaintance of an audience such as this with this book, we will not read a large portion of it for the sake of time. Esther chapter 1 and verse number 1, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 170 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast. Drop down to verse 5. And when those days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan. Verse 9. And Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to the king. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehunam and Bistha and Harbona and Bigtha and Abagtha and Zethar and Carcass, the seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with a royal crown to show the people and the princess her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment. Now look down in chapter 2. In those days when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and so on. Verse 5, now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother was dead, took for his own daughter. And so it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree were heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. Verse 10, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Verse 17, and the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then, of course, at the end you have, in verse 19, Mordecai in his exaltation to the gate, his place of prominence there. And chapter 3 begins, in those days of the king, I should have mentioned that you have Mordecai discovering the plot against the king and saving the king's life. And chapter 3 begins, in those days, the king Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat over all the princes that were with him. And then Haman moves with that title, and Mordecai refuses to bow before him, and we read in verse 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath, for he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for that he had shown him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai, in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, or pure, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day, from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now God will bless the reading of these very familiar portions of the Word of God. There are many delightful themes that could be traced to great profit in the little book of Esther. It would be delightful to spend time looking at the man that sat in the gates. Mordecai is the man of sorrows sitting in the gates, marked out as a man marked by. There would be great profit to looking at the garments that he wore. Six different garments clad this man Mordecai. And we can look at those, the garments of a captive, the garments that he rents, the garments he refused, the garments of sackcloth and ashes, garments of royalty that the king placed upon him when he was paraded through the streets, garments as well of regal majesty when he walked in the king's courts and he became greater and greater. We could look as well at the growth of this man Mordecai, for he is introduced to us as a man whose name means little. But you recall how when he closes in chapter 10, he is spoken of as being great and speaking peace and being a blessing to his own people and generations to come. The growth of this man Mordecai in the school of God. But I would like, because it has been upon my heart, and especially in light of what we have heard this morning, to look together at the greatness of God's sovereignty as seen in the life of Mordecai and Esther in this delightful book. Sometimes the ministry that we give it is upon our heart. God uses circumstances of life, everyday things, to impress truth upon us. And then in turn, that truth is valuable to the people of God. There are three things lately that have been a tremendous burden to my own soul and a means of perplexity. There was, first of all, a war in the Gulf, and all of the movements of nations there, and the belligerence of a man, and the reaction of other nations. And we say very clearly that absolute righteousness is not in the camp of any nation. We are not taking sides here. But nevertheless, there were the great movements of nations. Then as well, there was a woman that I sat with recently. She had lost, in one moment's time, four members of her family from a fiery crash in a car. She is not in the assembly, but a professing Christian. And a year and a half after that tragedy, she was still sitting in front of me saying, "Why? Why? I cannot understand why." Just a month ago, I stood by a bedside. A young brother, 32 years of age, in the assembly in our area, stood with his widow, his wife, soon to be a widow, looking upon a young man and all of her dreams. They had wanted to give themselves to that assembly. They had moved close to it. They had made it their goal and their exercise to put the assembly first. And there was a tremendous need for that assembly. And their exercise before God was to give themselves to the assembly and to seek to help in any way they could. Hospitality, Sunday school works, gospel work, whatever it was, they were there. Not only was her husband upon a bed, life ebbing from him, but every hope and every dream and every aspiration for the future was laying upon a hospital bed, and the beeps upon the monitor were soon going to stop. Why? Now, she didn't ask that. To her credit, she did not ask that. But I ask it. Why? I said somewhere recently that I began my Christian life thinking I had most of the answers. And with time, I would maybe fill in the blanks and I'd have all the answers. Time has only given more questions, not answers. That is why I have looked together with you, first of all, in Isaiah chapter 26, and then back in this book. For what I would like to give you is what Isaiah calls a rock of ages. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind stops at God. There are problems, and there are difficulties, and there are perplexities, and there are tragedies. And in the end, the only answer is God himself. That is the answer. It is not somehow that we get some tremendous insight into, well, this happens, and five people get saved, there's over this tragedy, and the assembly is blessed. Thank God when that happens. But the majority of problems that we face, the majority of tragedies that we have to endure and have to see others go through, the only answer is God himself. That is the rock. That is the foundation upon which we must rely. When all the swirling problems mill around us and overwhelm us, God himself is the ultimate answer. Some might disagree with me, and I hope I will not remove some comfort and joy from some. That's not my purpose. I would wonder, I would seriously question, if we are going to have all the answers when we are home in heaven. We will have God himself in his fullness, and we will need no other answers. We will need nothing more than that. What a tremendous thing then to have this now in our souls, to be able to rest, stand firm and secure upon God himself. Now, I made a promise to be brief, friend. I just want to notice with you very simply the sovereignty of God as seen in the book of Esther. I hope you'll forgive an age-old theme. I hope you'll forgive something which is so obvious and simple and often preached upon. But I want to tell you what a comfort it is to my own soul and what a bedrock it is amidst all the problems that we face as the people of God in assembly life and in family life and in the world all around us. Notice with me, first of all, that God is sovereign over the events of nations. God is sovereign in the events of nations. You'll notice in chapter 1, if you take time to look at it, there are four things that stand out that mark chapter 1 and mark our day just as well. In chapter 1, first of all, there is the wantonness of the day. People just eating and drinking, feasting and making merry with no thought of God and no thought of righteousness and no thought of the people of God. There is absolute wantonness of the day. People given over to eating and drinking. Not just little parties, mind you. I hope you realize when you come to chapter 1 of Esther, it is not simply a nice supper that this came through. It was a sensual orgy. It was a feast that was to satisfy every kind of appetite in Esther chapter 1. The wantonness of the day. But notice as well the wickedness of this king. Don't think that this is some sentimental, soft king that somehow God decided, oh, there's a kind man I can use. Look at how nice he is. This man is a wicked man in chapter 1. Make no doubt about it. There is as well the willfulness of this woman. I will not come, she says. And then there is the wiliness of all the conspirators and all the counselors. They are all there in chapter 1. The scene is tremendous in its relevancy to our own day. As we see nations moving and coming and going and events coming in and transpiring in our world and economies going up and down, and we wonder what's behind it all. Let us be confident in this one great thing. There is a hand of God behind it all. Perhaps I should just mention again very simply, what is the idea of God being sovereign? Is it the idea that God makes wars happen and God makes someone kill someone else and God does this? That's not the idea of God's sovereignty. As I look in my Bible, the idea of the sovereignty of God is this. God, having given man a free will, if his own creatures choose to use that free will in rebellion against him, he will nevertheless work out his purposes by using the very wickedness of men to accomplish his purposes. He will use men to bring about his own purposes. Come with me for just a moment in your thinking to Luke chapter 2. Can you imagine in your thinking, so for just a moment, picture that big king there in Rome, Caesar Augustus. I think it's time I took a census, and I think it's time I knew how great my empire was, so just send everyone back to their town to be enrolled. He was moving in his ignorance and in his pride, undoubtedly. God says, fine, I will use that to bring Mary and Joseph back to Bethlehem for my son to be born. Think as well of Acts chapter 18, another king again, Claudius. He decides all Jews should depart from Rome. Troublemakers, have them out. God will use that to bring a couple, Aquila and Priscilla, to Corinth. And along comes Paul. And together they are there, a home ready for Paul for the work in Corinth. But something even more than that. Where was it that Paul learned of the assemblies in Rome? Where was it that Paul got the burning to write back of the great need that existed in Rome? Nights spent together possibly making tents with Aquila and Priscilla, who had lately come from Rome, would that one undoubtedly tell him of what had occurred there? The tremendous interweaving of events by the sovereign hand of God. No easy thing for Joseph and Mary to get up and move away to another city. No easy thing for these two people, Priscilla and Aquila, to leave a home in Rome and go up to Corinth. The hand of God behind it all. The sovereignty of God in the movements of nations. God is sovereign over the events of nations. But as well, God is sovereign in the errors of his people. God is sovereign in the errors of his people. Now, I am not here to tell you because I shrink before the stature of this man, Mordecai. I am not here to point out his failures and faults, but I would see at least three problems in the book of Esther. There is, first of all, the problem of guilty silence. I do not believe that Mordecai told Esther to be quiet because he had some grand scheme in the end. Just don't tell him you're a Jew. Just keep it quiet. That might hinder things. The problem of guilty silence. There's the problem as well of a mixed marriage. Esther married, a Jew married to a Gentile? God never intends that. There's a problem of the questionable place in the harem as well that could have come from this had the king not chosen her. But you see, God is over all, even in the errors of his people. God can take the mistakes. God can take the failures of his people and from that bring out that which is for his purposes, that which is for his glory, that which is for his honor. Think just a moment, if you can, of those 10 brothers down in the land. They sold Joseph. God would use their mistake for Joseph's blessing. God would use what they did to Joseph for Joseph's blessing and for their blessing as well. Think of a man and his nephew. Think of Abraham and Lot. Just let your mind go back there for a moment and just take it out of the phraseology we're so accustomed to. There's the older man. There's the younger man. There's the spiritual man. There's the carnal man. There's the leader of the group. There's a follower. There's a strife. Abraham says, maybe, brethren, let's not argue over this. You just take what you want, and I'll just take the rest. If you and I were standing there, we would doubtless say, well, certainly, Lot's going to recognize that's his uncle. That's his uncle. I'll certainly give him the best. We would have thought, well, certainly, Lot's going to say, Abraham, you're a far more spiritual man than I. You take it. He's going to say, Abraham, you're the leader. I'm only a follower. You know what Lot did? I want the best. Give me that land that looks like Egypt, the well-watered plains. That's the best part. Give it to me. I'll take it. He took the best. When Lot was departed from Abraham, God said to Abraham, Abraham, lift up thine eyes now and look towards the north, towards the south, towards the west, and towards the east. Oh, wait a minute, God. Wait a minute. That's the land that Lot chose. It doesn't matter. You look in all directions. It's all going to be yours someday. It's all yours. Doesn't matter what Lot said he would take. God saw to it that the man that would wrong one of his own, God would see his welfare. So look, let's make this very practical. Let us make this exceedingly simple and down to earth. Do you believe, young believer, do you sincerely believe that if another believer does you wrong, do you believe that God is able to right it in your favor in the end? Do you really believe that if someone does you wrong and doesn't give you the place you think you deserve, someone doesn't recognize you for who you think you really are, you really think that somehow you've got to right it? Do you really think that somehow you've got to take matters in your own hand and say, well, now look, I'm not getting my rights? Just leave it with God. You have a sovereign Lord who is able to work out his own purposes at his own time, in his own way, for his own glory. That is what men of God have learned in Scripture, to leave things with God. Mistakes. God is sovereign over the errors of his people. John Crosby lived in upstate New York in the 1800s. 1821, in fact, John Crosby died. To make matters worse, a year before, John Crosby had a little girl. To add to the problem, at 6 weeks of age, that little girl, by the mistake of a physician, was blinded for life. To add to the problem, that little girl's mother had to go out to work. And that little girl was left with a grandmother. Each night, that grandmother would take that child and, through her own eyes, would describe to her the wonders of God's creation and the beauty of it all. And they would sing together hymns from the hymnal, and she would read it and read to her from the Scriptures. And into that little girl's mind was constantly being placed this thought by a grandmother: God has a plan for everyone's life, even yours. In 1903, that little girl, Fanny Crosby, wrote, "The poor doctor who spoiled my eyes soon disappeared. He is probably dead now. But," she said, "if I could ever meet him, I would tell him that unwittingly he did me the greatest favor in all my life. I would say thank you. Thank you." She went on to say that although that doctor made a mistake, it was no mistake with God. Can you take that from God? That whatever happens in your life, now I'm not talking about sin and departure and the reaping of what we have sown. I am just talking about the events in your life. Willing to take it as from God, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind stops at God. That's as far as the explanations can go. That's as far as they need go. Just that it is God Himself who has brought this into your life. There are some, and I know this was once asked me, and I will be very blunt about it. Some once asked me, supposing someone is unfair to you in proposal of marriage, an engagement, an interest, and all of a sudden you're left high and dry. I was planning on this for my life. Now do I have to go for second best? The person whose mind stops at God never, never gets second best. Doesn't matter what happens in your life. If you have God before you, you will never have second best in your life for God. God will give you the very best in your life. But I want to hurry on. I want you to notice as well that God is sovereign over the evil in the world. I don't know how you feel at times. Maybe Canada and Toronto is different from the U.S. I hope it is. But sometimes reading newspapers and looking at billboards and hearing people talk, sometimes you're almost overwhelmed by the sense of evil and the sense of the powers of darkness that are arrayed against God and against His Christ. All the marshaling of the forces of wickedness to somehow frustrate God and to somehow make God's work so difficult and make it so impossible. But I want to tell you that Esther teaches me that God is sovereign over the evil that is in the world. We read together that God is sovereign, God is greater than the secret counsels of men. Back there in chapter 3, is it? They're getting together, and there's Haman, and there's the king, and they are secretly, and the money passes back and forth, and the deal is made, and everything is just so secure. The secret counsels of the wicked. God blows upon the whole thing, means nothing to God. The secret counsels of men, God is far greater. You recall, don't you? Those men got together one day there in Matthew, it's recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. We've got to put this man to death. We've got to put Christ to death. But one thing, one restriction, just one qualification, not on the feast day. That's the only time. Not on the feast day. God said, on the feast day. The leader said, not on the feast day. Well, who do you think won? How did God do it? If you trace it out very simply, it's very, very simple. It's delightful to notice. A woman coming with an alabaster box of ointment, and she pours it upon the Savior, and Judas is inflamed with anger and with greed. He goes away to rulers and says, I'll give them to you. What will you give me? And they've got to compromise their one qualification. Because now we're at the mercy of this man, Judas, whenever he can give them to us, to take them. You see, God is able to overcome the counsels of ungodly men. But God is greater likewise than the slander of men. Mordecai, he may well be slandered by these men. But God is able to see to it that he will be honored. But what really delighted my soul when I first noticed it, and my brethren will bear with my simplicity and my density sometimes, you read things time and again and you scarcely ever recognize it. Let me put it like this, that God is greater than the superstitions of wicked men. What do I mean? We read there that Haman cast pur, cast lots, really, is the idea. In other words, he was looking for, in his superstition and in his idolatry, what would be the best day to put these Jews to death? Now, did you notice when he began? When he began casting pur? The first month. When did the lot come up? 12 months. 12 whole months? You see, God was making it very clear. He was going to extend it as long as he could in that year to give his people time, to give this whole thing an effort to be worked through, that his people might be saved. God overruled even that superstition, even that casting of lots, even that which doubtless these people thought that somehow our God is in control of all of this, and our idols and so on, and we'll just see which will be the best day. God used even that darkness of men. He used even their superstition to bring his own purposes to pass. God is greater than the evil that is all around us in a dark world. But I want you to notice, and of course this is what we are most familiar with, that God is sovereign in the exactness of his timetable. We didn't read it together, it's so well known. The night that he could not sleep, and in that night he called for the book, and in that night Haman came, and in that night he read at the very right place. I mean, you know, there are so many things there that are just in the exactness of God's doings, that night. We mentioned again the errors of God's people, didn't we? Esther asked for the king and for Haman to come to her feast. I think she got cold feet the first time around. I think she just got scared. And she said, come back tomorrow. The king said, well, what's your request? What did you bring us here for? I'll give it to you, whatever it is, on behalf of my kingdom. What is it? Come back tomorrow. I'm a little afraid right now. It was that very night. It was a night sandwiched between her cold feet and her courage that God used to tell this man Haman he was on the way down. That very night, could not the king sleep? And he called for the books, and he opened it to the very place. And just when he's reading it, the very man that is the very cause of all the problems coming in, and in his wicked heart is running those proud thoughts, and it leads to his own downfall. God is sovereign over the superstition that is in the world as well. God is not somehow at a loss. Never think that God is somehow scrambling to find some new strategy to work his purposes out and to bring you to where he wants to and to bring the assembly to where he wants to. Listen, can I say very simply, our minds are small and our minds are so limited in our grasp of things. God has something far more at stake than you and me. It is the glory and honor of his Son that is at stake. In this wicked world, God is going to bring back a man to reign over the earth in righteousness. God has something far more at stake than just your welfare and mine. The glory and honor of his Son and the honor of his own name. God is exact. He is sovereign in the exactness of his timetable. But I want to close by noticing as well that God is sovereign in the experience of his people. God is sovereign in the experiences of his people. Now, we could look at Mordecai and the fact that he was brought to a place of employment at just the time when there was a plot being concocted and he is able to hear it and he is able to divulge it to the king. And we could talk as well about how in that place of faithfulness, suddenly another man is promoted over him, and not just promoted over him, but promoted over him and putting him down. Trial and difficulty, it's all there. But I want you to notice very especially the sovereignty of God in the events and in the experiences of this woman, Esther. Maybe the best way for me to say it is just to sum it up in a very simple way. There is nothing superfluous in your life or mine. Now, can I say that again? And could you just understand what I'm saying? That there is nothing superfluous in a believer's life when it is ordered of God. What do I mean? Her bondage? Just an accident? Just an accident that Esther is down there in Shushan, the palace, in that land under bondage? You might see it as an accident, but God doesn't. Her beauty? Ever think that the way you are, your personality and your looks are ordered of God? We all want to look better. We all want to be different. I am always amazed, and I am not I'm not throwing a stone at anybody, you'll understand. I deal with people all day, and I usually hear the same thing. If only I weighed more or only I weighed less, I would just be perfect. And every patient has the same thing. If it weren't for this, I'd be great. You know, if I could just lose 5 pounds. We all have this image of some little thing that's keeping us from being, you know, just wonderful. There is nothing superfluous in your life, no excess baggage in the Christian experience. Her very beauty, her winsome personality, all of that was of God's direction. But what about her being an orphan? Was that of God's doing? Was God sovereign over that great a tragedy? A young girl, a young babe, doubtless orphaned as a small infant, was that of God's doing? Was God sovereign in that as well? Can't you hear the old women down there in Persia talking? What's that old man going to do with that young girl? What does he know about raising a child? Can you see them all standing along the sidelines and talking and murmuring? Why in the world is old Mordecai taking that girl home to be his daughter? What does he know about raising children? Pity the poor girl. What a sad lot for her to be, just to be with that man. And you know how the rumors would spread and all would go on. Nothing superfluous. Nothing superfluous. Orphaned as a child, as an infant, not superfluous, not an accident, not a mistake in the dealings of God. God had these two things to bring together, Esther and Mordecai. No tragedies with God in that sense. No mistakes with God. So often, the very things that God has brought into our life to make us useful, we view as tremendous obstacles to our usefulness and service for God. For 100 years after Columbus discovered America, the world looked upon North America as a big obstacle, something in the way. They were all looking for the way to the Orient, how to get to India, how to get to the other side of the world quickly. And so the English and the French sent in men looking for the Northwest Passage, and the Spaniards sent in men going to the south, looking for a shortcut to the other side of the world as well. And for 100 years that went on. And beneath their feet was gold and everything else they could want. And they kept trudging over it, giving their lives and dying uselessly because they thought what was of value was over there. 100 years later, they began realizing what's of value is right here. What we have viewed as an obstacle is, in fact, the very blessing we're looking for. Many times in the believer's life, the very thing you view as a barrier, the very thing you view as an obstacle, it is the very thing God has put there to be a means of blessing to you and to others. She was an orphan. She was beautiful. She had a pleasant personality. She was single. She was single, not married. If she had been married, of course, none of this could have occurred. Even her marital status was under the sovereign control of God. Could I just speak encouragingly to some here? That doesn't mean you shouldn't look. And it doesn't mean if someone asks, you say no. Fat chance of that, even if I told you. But you'll understand what I mean when I say that even your status before God as single or married, whatever God has chosen, that is under God's sovereign control. He can use it for the furthering of His purposes and for your blessing and the blessing of the assembly you're with and the help of the people of God. God is sovereign in the experience of his people. There are no superfluous things in the life of a child of God. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a president of the U.S., unknown to many people at the time, had suffered very severely from polio. But at that time, things were quite different than they are today. There was an unwritten code among reporters and photographers for newspapers that no one would ever ask about it, and that no photographs would ever be taken when FDR was struggling with his crutches or having difficulty getting to his feet. One day, Mrs. Roosevelt was at a convention in Akron, Ohio, and the unthinkable happened. She was answering questions that were written down and being submitted to her, and from one journalist came the question, and as she read it, she realized what she was reading too late. Do you think your husband's polio has affected his mentality? The entire room became hushed. Every eye was riveted upon her, wondering how could she possibly answer that question? After a moment, she composed herself and she said, I'm glad that question was asked. And I want to tell you the answer is absolutely yes. It has affected his mentality. For there is no one that could go through all the suffering he has gone through and not view human suffering in a totally different way. It has. You see, what was viewed as a tragedy by one became the very means of blessing to another. God is sovereign. Could I just close once again by reminding you of this tremendous rock, not just for now, but Isaiah calls it the rock of ages. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind stops at God.